us to find him doing so when he returns. I tell you the truth, he will put him in charge of all his possessions. But suppose that servant is wicked and says to himself, my master is staying away a long time. And then he begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with drunkards. The master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him and at an hour he is not aware of. He will cut him to pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth.
I'm just going to adjust the microphone. And I feel like a roo in a spotlight. I'm waiting for a hillbilly to shoot me with his gun or something. I don't know. Look, before I kick off the sermon, can I just have a whinge? On Wednesday nights, I watch Millionaire Hot Seat with my father-in-law. That's what we do on Wednesday. I don't have much in common with my father-in-law, but I love quizzes and trivia, and he loves quizzes and trivia, and so for half an hour we pretend that we could win $1 million because we're so clever. But last Wednesday, the most heinous thing happened that could happen. I sat my father-in-law down in the couch next to me. We were ready for Hot Seat Millionaire, and I turned on the television, and what did I see? The US elections. Donald Trump turned up in my place when I expected that other guy. I was so cranky. And the Hot Seat Millionaire is something I do with my father-in-law to relax. And I could see his hackles go up. And, you know, the news reporters are going on, who's going to be the president? What's going to happen to the world with the wrong president? Drama, drama, catastrophe, drama. And I'm sitting there going, and it's like a slow motion. I'm running for the controls. And I turned off the controls before everything broke out. I was really ticked off because it wasn't on the program guide. I checked my television. It wasn't on the program guide. What is Donald Trump doing on my television when he's not meant to be on my television? And why am I watching something in so much... Why am I watching an election from another country in so much detail? What am I meant to do with this information? Seriously. Why has Channel 9 decided that I should be alert to the machinations of foreign politics? I was sitting down and thinking about the last couple of days and I thought this. I think when you're alert to things you have no control of, it leads to anxiety. I've listened to people be alert to foreign politics and this and that, and they can't do anything about it. You know, one of the downsides of a global culture is trauma. We get traumatized by things happening overseas because we participate in things we can't do anything about, and you get very, very traumatic. But then the opposite happens. If you're alert to things that you can control, you move from being in an anxious state to an empowered state. So currently Bronwyn and I are on a... I'm putting it out there, Bron, why not? We're on a diet because we've got to lose weight. Now, I can be alert to my weight and monitor it and then do something about it, and that's empowering. If you're alert to your lifestyle, you can make the changes to your lifestyle. When those changes happen, you're empowered. It's very, very different, isn't it? Today, there's my whinge. Thank you for listening. I am talking about alertness. And what should Christians be alert to? Last week, Alan was very, very, very helpful. What I took home from last week's sermon is that God has a timetable. Bad things are going to happen. There's going to be fakes that are going to turn up. There's going to be earthquakes and famines, and indeed there is if you're in the Philippines at the moment. Christians are going to be hated. And these things are tough things, but as Christians, we're cool with it, aren't we? Because it's part of a timetable. When you know some things are part of a timetable, you know they're there for a reason and God put them there for a reason. Whether we know the reason or not, we're cool with it. And so Alan is so right. We just stand firm. We're not in control, but we know the bloke who is in control and therefore no anxiety is raised. So we stand firm and we just keep loving. You know, while wickedness increases and love freezes, we stand firm as Christians. But here's the question. Later on, I think it's in verse 42. It says to keep watch or be alert. What should we be alert for as Christians? What should we be alert? Keep that in your head. What are you alert for as a Christian that is helpful? Well, I'm going to talk about two things: why we should be alert and how we should be alert. You ready? Why should we be alert? Here's the simple answer: Jesus is coming back. That's why we should be alert. In the great words of the philosopher Arnold Schwarzenegger, I'll be back. And Jesus will be coming back. This is why we should be alert. Now, I'm going to look at three things that Jesus says about his returns. They're three simple things, but I want to look at them because it'll give you a good reason why. You ready? Verses 26 and 27. Reason number one that Jesus says to be alert. So if anyone tells you, there he is out in the wilderness, don't go out. Or here he is in the inner room, don't believe it. For as lightning that comes from the east is visible even in the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. The first thing Jesus wants his followers to know is that when he returns, he will return like a lightning storm. And the good thing, did you like the passage? The way you see lightning from east to west is the way Jesus will return. The ironic thing about Jesus returning is there will be no news reports on it. Because the way a news report works is a journalist is in an area a group of people aren't, and what they do is they talk about the thing happening over there to the people over here. And the funny thing is, when Jesus returns in such a universal way, you won't need the news report because everyone is going to know. So I want you to know that Jesus is going to return like a lightning storm. It's not going to be a private experience where you've got to go to a special retreat or know a special person at a special time. It's going to be a universal, hyper-public event. Now, when I was in Mortdale Primary School about 10 years now, it was summer, it was a wet, rainy day, and there was a thunderstorm, a lightning storm, and you could hear when everyone's going, oh, because, you know, lightning storms are cool. You can see the flashing in the distance. And what was the game that everyone played, that everyone plays in a lightning storm? You do the count, don't you? You do the flash and you go, 1-100, 2-100, 3, crack, and the lightning goes off. I love doing that because I'm a nerd, because I love knowing if the time distance is getting smaller or bigger. Am I the only one in the church that does that, please? Am I? I am. Ute says, yeah, you're the only one that does it, brother. I love doing it, and we were doing it at the school, and I was there with a group of parents, and you know, it was flash. You go 1-100, 2-100, and went 6, boom, you know, and then another one, 4, and we thought it was really cool, and then it went flash. We went 1, boom, and it was funny. I've never seen women in prams move vertically than horizontally. Everyone was scared. I too jumped. We were scared, and it was not fun anymore. And the funny thing was, in retrospect, is what did we dive under? We dived under the metal shelter, you know. But at the time, when you experience a lightning storm in the midst of it and its power, and the power catches you unaware, all of a sudden you feel small, and all of a sudden that great event you talk about at a distance isn't that. It's just really scary, really humbling, and for a moment I hope this goes away quickly because it's too much. Can you see what I'm trying to say? Jesus' return is a lightning storm. Second point, verses 29 to 30, this will not surprise you. We'll get there. Jesus' return will upset the natural order of things. Listen to this, verse 29. Immediately after the distress of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from the sky, and the heavenly bodies will be shaken. Then will appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. And then all the peoples of the earth will mourn. Full on, isn't it? Jesus is going, when I come back, I will disrupt the natural order of things. And as you can see that verse 29, the sun darkening, the moon darkening, you can see that Jesus is quoting. Now, Jesus is quoting Joel. Joel is very big on the end of the world, as is Isaiah. And Jesus captures that to say something about his return. And there it is in Joel chapter 3. Listen to this, because Blind Freddy could work this out. This is not rocket science, okay? Listen to what Joel says. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision. For the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. The sun and the moon are darkened and the stars withdraw their shining. There's a picture in Joel that when God comes back, enough is enough. Enough. Everyone stand in my presence, multitudes upon multitudes. Stand in my presence, a decision has to be made, and I'll be making the decision. I cannot wait for the judgment day where Jesus' judgment is going to be pure. And Jesus, unlike every other judge on the planet, will know the crystal clear motives of all actions. He will have all the evidence. He will know all the witnesses. He knows what they're thinking. He knows everything. And no amount of money is going to get people out of justice. And Jesus goes, I am the day of the Lord. I am judgment day. He's going to judge the nations. And you notice in that verse that the nations will mourn. And I think the nations will mourn for a multitude of reasons. But I think everyone, there's an interesting stat that came out of Sydney Uni in the 1990s. It said that 95% of people had an opinion of Jesus and less than 1% actually read anything about Jesus. Hilarious, something like that. Isn't it funny to have an opinion on a person you don't know? People have an opinion on Jesus and they said he was this and that. They're going to mourn because they're going to find out he is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. And I think people are going to mourn because they realize I am accountable to somebody and I know myself well enough to know that it's not good. It's pretty full on, isn't it? I've lost my point because I was so moved by that. Third thing, number one, is like a lightning storm. Number two, he comes to judge the nations and give justice. Third and final point I want to make is in verse 30-31, his return isn't just about judgment, it's about gathering. Verse 30. Then will appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then all the peoples of the earth will mourn when they see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heavens to the other. So if I got this right. Jesus is going to judge, number one. What's he going to do according to verse 31? What's he going to do? He's going to send his angels to do what? Gather what? His elect. What's an elect person? Someone that is chosen. So can you imagine, I don't know what it will look like, but Jesus will return. Everyone will know from east to west. He will judge, and then he's going to go, boys, I don't know if you'd say that to angels, but you go, boys, go get them. Go get my people. I want my people now. I've judged the old and now I'm creating the new. And surprise, surprise, guess what? Jesus again, when he uses that quote about the Son of Man in verse 30, coming on a cloud, he's quoting his Old Testament again. Out of Daniel 7, for those of you who like beasts, listen to this. Behold, with the clouds of heaven, there will come one like the Son of Man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and he was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom so that all peoples, nations, languages should serve him. And his dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will not be destroyed. It's a cool picture. God goes, son, now is the time. And he's going to give him dominion and glory and a kingdom. Who is in his kingdom? Do you love the English? Peoples. That's my ESL. Peoples from all nations. There's in the kingdom of God. Can't wait. The Indos will be there. My Indo brothers and sisters. South Americans will be there. The Indians will be there. The Aussies will be there. Even Tasmanians will be there. If they believe in the Lord Jesus. Doesn't matter what their border rules are. But isn't that a great picture that he receives a kingdom? To have a kingdom, you need people. So he will judge the earth and gather his people into a kingdom that can't be corrupted and all that sort of stuff. For those Bible nerds, I don't know if you know Daniel 7, but the Son of Man doesn't come till after the four beasts are destroyed. And it's interesting, in the Bible they described world politics as beasts. And that makes sense, because politicians act like animals. Kingdoms act like animals. They think they can treat people any way they like. Makes you sick, doesn't it? And when the beasts are done doing their beastly things, the true human being will come and will fix everything up. This is why we're alert. This is it. We're in distressful days. Why we're alert? Because we know Jesus is coming to judge and to gather and to make us live the way we're meant to live. But here's the $10 million question. What are we meant to be alert to? You know, if I've got to be alert, where's my alertness concentrated? Now, here's the frustrating thing. It can't be about timing. It can't be about world events. I'll tell you why. Because in verse 42, 44, and 50, he says, no one will know when the Son of Man comes. So there's no point looking at world events, because they won't help you know when the Son of Man comes. If you don't believe me, again, 42, he says, you don't know when the Son of Man's coming. Verse 44, you don't know when the Son of Man's coming. Verse 50, you don't know when the Son of Man's coming. Actually, verse 36, the Son of Man doesn't know when he's coming, because his dad's got to let him off the leash at the time that dad chooses. So it's not about being alert to the times. The alertness is not about when, it's about who. And this is our take-home value. And it goes from verse 45. Listen to where your alertness should be. Ready? Who then is the faithful and wise servant whom the master has put in charge of the servants in his household to give them their food at the proper time? It'll be good for that servant whose master finds him doing so when he returns. Truly, I tell you, he will put him in charge of all his possessions. But suppose the servant's wicked and he says to himself, my master's staying away a long time. You know, then he begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and to drink with drunkards. The master of that servant will come on a day that he doesn't expect him to, at an hour he's not aware of. And then he's going to just cut him up to pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Verse 45 tells me, don't get focused on world events. If you want to be alert about something, be alert about yourself. Now, please hear me. I think Joan's prayers were right. The only reason I think that Christians are to be aware of world events is twofold. One, to pray, because the Bible says we should pray for our leaders and other leaders. So we must be aware of world events, to pray for the church and the leaders of other countries. And two, to be responsible citizens where we can of this global community. But after that, don't buy into the catastrophizing and dramatizing of the journalists of all the channels. That's misplaced urgency. The urgency should be in this. Who then is a faithful servant? Or if you like, in verse 46, the faithful servant is the servant that does the job, their job that their master's given them in their household. So the important question to ask is, am I doing what my Lord wants me to do in his household? That's the real thing you should be alert to. Ask yourself, am I doing what my Lord wants me to do in his household? I want to share something with you I didn't think about in the 8 o'clock service. I'll share with you. Do you know what a vocation is? What's a vocation? A calling. Is Christianity a vocation? Yes. We are being called by the Lord. And when you look at Romans 10, 9 and 10, that's the definition of a Christian and the definition of how to be saved. In Romans 10, 9 and 10, it tells you that a Christian is someone who calls Jesus Lord. And you reap the benefits of the cross. So a Christian is someone that lives as though Jesus is their boss. Does that make sense? Often as Christians, we're selfish. We think that Jesus is like a mobile phone, a supplement to our lifestyle to make our life better. And indeed, Jesus does improve our lifestyle. And indeed, Jesus does improve quality of life. But he is not a mobile phone or a lifestyle change. He is the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. So we must ask, am I a good and faithful servant to my Lord? That's the right question to ask. Indeed, verse 46, I don't like this particular translation. Here it says, it is good for the servant whose master finds him doing so. The word is actually blessed. Blessed, I'll just talk like an Old Testament guy. Blessed is the servant whom the master finds doing so when he comes. We're called to serve, and when Jesus comes back, if he sees you doing what he wanted you to do, he's going to go, yes, and I'm going to bless you now. And more importantly, I would say, I think when a Christian acts with integrity, they are not only blessed, but they become a blessing to others, because that's when our faith is clearest, when Jesus' lordship is visible in our decisions, not just in our words. Remember, you're not saved if you believe that Jesus died for you on the cross. You're saved if you call him Lord. There's a controversial statement, Romans 10, 9 and 10. But don't hear me saying it's about good things, doing good things. It's about keeping your identity. So if you like, if blessed is the person who does what his master wants, then cursed is the Christian who abandons the role that Jesus gave them. Cursed is the Christian who lives like there is no Lord. That makes sense, doesn't it? What does it look like? It looks like this. One angle is, we were saved to serve. So if a Christian is not serving other Christians, maybe he's not. We are called into a community. If we won't participate in the Christian community, maybe we're not called. Am I a good son if I say to my mum, oh, mum says, when are you coming over? I'm going to my mum's place this Monday, so just be cool, I visit my mum. Would it be okay if mum says, oh, when are you coming over? Look, I want to come over, but I'm busy at the moment. And like, I don't have to come over to be your son, do I? Maybe I'll see you in 2 months. Is that all right? Because you don't have to go to church. You don't have to go to church to be a Christian. I mean, sorry, you can be a Christian, but you don't have to go to church, do you? It's like being a son, but you don't have to visit your mum. Can you see what I'm trying to say? We're saved for community, and if a Christian refuses to be part, if someone calls themselves a Christian and won't be part of a Christian community, I question. And what would the Lord say? What do you call a word-only Christian? I'll give you a clue. The word's in verse 51. What do you call a person that's a Christian word-only? Hypocrite. There's an interesting thing. I think it's a threat. I actually think Jesus is threatening us. And this reminds me, it's not that Christianity is a vocation and Jesus is our boss. He came as the undercover boss and it went very badly for him. When he comes next time, he won't be undercover. And we want to be ready when the boss is here. And he says to hypocrites, they go to this place of weeping and gnashing of teeth. The interesting thing is that Jesus is, I think he's the only one that mentions the place weeping and gnashing of teeth. He says it 5 times in Matthew. And it's where the hypocrites go. What does weeping mean? You're sad. What does that tell you about hell? Perpetual sadness. Eternal sadness. What's gnashing of teeth? Now, I thought gnashing of teeth had to do with kettlebell lifting, but that's clearly not in the Bible. I found out what gnashing of teeth is to do with anger. Isn't it interesting that hell is called a place of weeping and gnashing of teeth, perpetual sadness, perpetual anger? Indeed, it's called in 3 times in Matthew 8, 22 and 25, he calls it the outer darkness. Outer to what? Outer to his kingdom, yeah, where his people are gathered. And in Matthew 13, it's called a fiery furnace. Now, you go, wait a minute, how do you have a furnace in utter darkness? It's clearly a metaphor, and you can see what he's trying to say. It's pretty full on. I want to encourage you, okay? Be alert to the right things, and don't buy into the alertness of the wrong things. Be alert to whether you're a good and faithful servant, not because you've got to earn your way to heaven, but you've got to maintain your identity at a time where your identity can be diluted by all the other demands in your life. And rejoice. When Jesus returns, there will be justice in a way that there's never been justice. And there's going to be community in a way there's never been community. And in the meantime, lived, like Joan said, what's that quote again? What does God want from you, oh man? Yeah, so live like the community we are, and call more and more people in, because when the Lord comes, it'll be too late for them. Graham, do you want to get your team to lead us in our next song, O Glorious Day? I don't know, anything you want to say about that as a musician, just to catch you off guard completely?
One day he's coming.